Numbers chapter 32. If you'll notice, we are not far from the end. Most of those good things in Numbers that we spoke about at the beginning and have spoken about for some time have sort of passed on, and we are in this instruction stage to this new generation going into the Promised Land. These things aren't quite as exciting, and they don't mean nearly as much to us as they did to them, because these were important to these people going into the Promised Land. But I assure you that they're important to us in some way or another. There are reasons that God put these things in His book, if for no other reason that we can see how faithful He is and how unfaithful we often are. I mean, maybe that's what the point is. I know that God's Word is reliable and it serves a purpose. And even where we have a hard time seeing it, even verses that are very obscure to us have a reason for being there. This is an interesting chapter a little bit, chapter 32, especially if you begin to read commentators, which I have a tendency to do when I'm studying. There are wide views on this chapter and why these things happened. I'll bring out some of those here in just a few minutes. Verse 1, chapter 32. Now the people of Reuben and the people of Gad had a very great number of livestock, and they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, and behold, the place was a place for livestock. So the people of Gad and the people of Reuben came and said to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the chiefs of the congregation, Ataroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Elalah, Sebam, Nebo, and Beon, the land that the Lord struck down before the congregation of Israel, is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock. And they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants for a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. But Moses said to the people of Gad and the people of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you sit here? Why will you discourage the heart of the people of Israel from going over to the land that the Lord has given them? Your fathers did this when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the people of Israel from going into the land that the Lord had given them. And the Lord's anger was kindled on that day, and He swore, saying, surely none of the men who came up out of Egypt from 20 years old and upward shall see the land that I swore to give Abraham, or give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, none except Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. And the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel, and He made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until all the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was gone. And behold, you have risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following Him, He will again abandon them in this wilderness, and you will destroy all this people. Interesting. There's more to the chapter. This is not the end of the conversation. We'll talk about that here in just a few moments. Various views of commentators on this. I'll deal with it in just a second. Here's the facts. The tribes of Reuben and Gad request land which had already been conquered. This is not the Promised Land. This is not the land of Canaan. This is not the land on the other side of the Jordan. This is land that had already been conquered by them and had plenty of a place for livestock. It was a good land. They had a lot of livestock. They seemed like the land fit them well, and they asked for it. Moses did not take it very well, because this is on the side of the Jordan opposite the Promised Land. The Promised Land is when you cross the Jordan, and they're still on the other side. And Moses is not in any way happy with them, as you may have picked up on if you read along with me there. I mean, Moses said, you're no different than the generation that died out in the wilderness. You're just a bunch of sinful people, and you're doing the same exact sin. I mean, that seems obvious what Moses is saying there. He's initially angry with these tribes, as he feels they are committing the same sin as the previous generation. when the spies were sent to search out the land. And he goes back through that in a paraphrase here. It's really difficult to know if his anger is justified. There's no way for us to know that, because what follows is what seems an immediate appeasement of his anger, what we're about to see. As they say, hey, we'll go. We just want this land. And he's okay with that. Whether they meant that initially or not, we don't know. We don't know. They could have initially meant, hey, we'll go help you with the war, but we just want this land when it's all over. And Moses didn't quite give them time enough to say that. That may be exactly what happened. They don't seem to back up at all in what they're about to say. But immediately when they say it, Moses is fine with that. Commentators do believe, some commentators I should say, do believe that this is a sinful request by the tribes. I actually asked some of my preaching buddies about this week, several of them. Billy Holbrook, Jason Schultz, John Fry, Troy McGahan, Mark Campbell. We had a big discussion about whether this was good or bad or whatever, and we went round and round, and some all those that read A.W. Pink believe that it's bad, you know, because he types up everything. He can type up anything. And no, we actually had a very interesting conversation and came to the point of saying, you know, you just can't know. You just can't know. I mean, God seems to bless this. At the end, God seems to allow it. He's not mad. Here's the view of the commentators that say that it's a sinful request. The crossing of the Jordan River is typical, and we see this in other places, of coming to Christ. It's typical of regeneration. You've crossed the Jordan River, and then you are in the promised land, not heaven. The Jordan River is not death. And the promised land is not heaven. It is more that victorious Christian life. Look, they're going to cross the promised land in the book of Joshua. They're not all saved. They're not all going to heaven. But they are living faithfully in the Lord, and they're having great progress and great success. So the promised land is a picture of a more of a victorious Christian life, following the Lord, living in His Word, fellowshipping with the saints, praying like you should, doing all the right things, and having that well of living water inside of you like Jesus was talking about. Just really enjoying your salvation. That's what the promised land would picture. And those commentators would say the fact that these refused to cross the promised land, they wanted to settle on the side opposite of the promised land, was a destroying of that type. And that therefore it's a sinful request. That makes good sense to me. But I don't know if it's right. You know, a lot of things make good sense, but that doesn't mean that they're right. If you study through the book of Revelation, you'll find there are 24 elders on thrones. And people will say, well, that's obviously the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 apostles, because 12 plus 12 equals 24. Well, that makes sense. But I don't believe that's right. I don't believe that those are typical of the 12 apostles and the 12 heads of the tribes. I don't believe that at all. I believe it's more typical of the church age saints, and that those are the ones that are there. That's just me. As the tribulation period is the time of Jacob's trouble, I don't think they have any real, representatives perhaps there at that time. And I think in Revelation that context will bear that out. They also say that when Jesus visited the Gadarenes in Matthew 8:34, that the state of the Gadarenes were proof of the place that they were spiritually. What happened when Jesus went over there? They were keepers of what kind of animals? Pigs. Were they supposed to be by the law? No. What happened when Jesus did this great miracle of casting out this legion and they went into the pigs? Did they say, oh, we can see that you're a teacher come from God? That's what Nicodemus said when he came. We can see that you're a teacher come from God, for no man can do these things except God is with him. Right? That's what Nicodemus said. These people said, please go away. We don't want you in our land. So they would say, see, the followers of Gad, the tribe of Gad, or the Gadarenes, their spiritual state in the day of Jesus just proves that they had made a great error. Well, I'm not sure that that's a very good argument, since the state of the entire nation of Israel at that time was pretty wretched. So I don't know that's a great argument, but nonetheless, I don't know if these people came with good intention or if they didn't. I don't know. I know this is what happened afterwards because we're about to read it. That part I got. Verse 16. Then they came near to him. So it seems to me that he says, you know, you're a bunch of sinners, you're doing wrong. Then they came near to him. We will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones, but we will take up arms, ready to go before the people of Israel. We won't follow from behind. We will go before the people of Israel until we have brought them to their place, and our little ones shall live in fortified cities because of the inhabitant of the land. In other words, they're saying, look, if you'll just give us time to build fortified cities, because there's no protection for our families from these other countries while we're gone. Let us build fortified cities, give us a bit, and then we will go ahead of the army into the land of Canaan and help them conquer. And we will not return back until all has been conquered. We will not return to our homes until each of the people of Israel has gained his inheritance. Verse 18, verse 19, for we will not inherit with them beyond on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has come to us on this side of the Jordan to the east. So Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will take up arms to go before the Lord for war, and every armed man of you will pass over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out all his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then after that you shall return and be free of obligation to the Lord and to Israel, and this land shall be your possession before the Lord. But if you do not, if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Build cities for your little ones and folds for your sheep, and do what you have promised. And the people of Gad and the people of Reuben said to Moses, your servants will do as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our livestock, and all our cattle shall remain there in the cities of Gilead. But your servants will pass over every man who is armed for war before the Lord to battle as my Lord orders. So after hearing this, Moses is immediately appeased. This doesn't, to me, seem like this is plan B for them. I mean, that's just me reading it, and maybe that's just because it's all in one chapter and it just reads easy that way. But it seems like this is their intention. I mean, they didn't say, look, we'll go over and help. Spread us out amongst the tribes, and some of us will help this tribe, and some of us will help this tribe. They said, we'll go before the tribes. We will lead the way in the march. I mean, they're putting their life on the line there. You know, the Marines, like, they go out in front of the rest of, you know, the army and all of these others. So they are willing to do the same thing. That's pretty big for me. And Moses immediately says, that's great. If you'll do that, then that will be fine. This land will be your possession, he says in verse 22, before the Lord. So it's almost the Lord's stamp of approval on this. Then he says in verse 23, he says something that we often hear quoted. But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. It doesn't say the way that it's often used, if you sin, it will be found out. That's not exactly what it says. It says your sin will find you out. That's different than if you sin, it will be found out. There's a lot of people that sin and it's not found out. There are murderers who have died, murderers, and still free, and nobody knew it until the judgment. God knew it. And they'll stand for it and they'll deal with it. Now, if Christ paid for that sin, they'll go to heaven. It's not that. I mean, Paul was a murderer. And, of course, he was forgiven in Christ. So there is forgiveness for murderers. Your sin will find you out. What often accompanies sin? Problems. Problems. And problems were going to accompany these people if they didn't do what they were supposed to do. Sometimes when you sin, nobody may know about the sin, but you may live with constant problems the rest of your life as a result of that. They may be mental, they may be personal, they may be whatever, physical. It's not that your sin will necessarily be found out, but the results of your sin will follow you. Your sin will find you out. He goes on and tells them, that's fine. Build cities for your little ones, the folds of your sheep. Then do what you've promised. He says, but if you don't, your sin will find you out. Verse 28. So Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua the son of Nun, to the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel. And Moses said to them, if the people of Gad and the people of Reuben, every man who is armed to battle before the Lord, will pass with you over the Jordan, and the land shall be subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. However, if they will not pass over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. And the people of Gad and the people of Reuben answered, what the Lord has said to your servants, we will do. By the way, if you turn over to the book of Joshua, you will find that they did exactly what they said they would do. After all the land was conquered, then they went back home. They were faithful to this. Verse 32, we will pass over armed before the Lord into the land of Canaan, and the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us beyond the Jordan. And Moses gave to them, to the people of Gad, to the people of Reuben, and to the half tribe of Manasseh. So we actually find out that it wasn't only Gad and Reuben. There was also half of the tribe of Manasseh that wanted to stay on this side. You'll see that all through the Old Testament. It's half of Manasseh was on one side of the Jordan and half was on the other side. To the half-tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, the land and its cities with their territories, the cities of the land throughout the country. And the people of Gad built Dibon, Ataroth, Arior, Atroth, Shophan, Jazer, Jogbaha, Beth Nimrah, and Beth Haran, fortified cities and folds for sheep. And the people of Reuben built Heshbon, Eleah, I can't say all these words, Carithaim, Nebo, and Baal-Meon, their names were changed. And Sibmah, I think it says their names were changed because in that particular instance, you see there was the name of Baal, and the point is made that the name was changed. And they gave other names to the cities that they built. And the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and captured it and dispossessed the Amorites who were in it. And Moses gave Gilead to Machir, the son of Manasseh, and he settled in it. And Jair, the son of Manasseh, went and captured their villages and called them Havoth Jair. And Nobah went and captured Kenath and its villages and called it Nobah after his own name. So Moses here gives instructions to Eleazar, Joshua, and the heads of the tribes concerning this request. And he basically says, look, do what they're requesting as long as they go do what they say they will do. But if they do not hold up their end of the bargain, they will settle in Canaan along with all of the other tribes. The fact that that is punishment to me seems to not exactly hold up the end of the bargain that it was okay. I mean, it seems to me like it was fine what they did. And then God seems to bless it. Moses puts his stamp of approval on it. I can't see that if this was completely wrong, that it would, number one, be pointed out in the New Testament, and it's not. And number two, that Moses would have been okay with it. He never is anywhere else when they're doing wrong. So I just don't see a big deal out of it, like some of the commentators say. All right, chapter 33. This is one of the more difficult chapters to walk through. We do not have a detailed account of everything that went on in the wilderness. I told you why. We have a few highlights that happened in the wilderness, but we don't have a detailed account of the wilderness wanderings. Why? Because it's a wasted time. Complete waste. And God's showing us that by not giving us a detailed account. But what we do have in chapter 33 is we have the activities of where they camped through this 40-year wandering. We do know that. Notice it says, verse 1, these are the stages of the people of Israel when they went out of the land of Egypt by their companies under the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Moses wrote down their starting places stage by stage by command of the Lord. And these are their stages according to their starting places. They set out from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the month. And on the day after Passover, the people went out triumphantly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them. On their gods also the Lord executed judgments. So the people of Israel set out from Ramses and camped at Succoth. They set out from Succoth and camped at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. They set out from Etham and turned back to Pi-Hahiroth, which is on the east side of Baal Zephon, and they camped before Migdol. They set out from Harathoth, or ever how you say that particular word, and passed through the midst of the Sea of the Wilderness, and they went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Ethan and camped at Marah. They set out from Marah and camped at Elam. I mean, this is it, over and over and over. They left one place, they went to another place. If you just continue reading, verse 23, they set out from Kehelapha and camped at Mount Shepher. They set out from Mount Shepher and camped at Haradah. I mean, it's just, there's no real information about what happened at any of these places. These are just places they camped. This is just wasted time. Wasted time. This is time that God is waiting for that generation to die out so that the next generation enters in. It's just wasted time. But if nothing else, because you're not going to read this chapter and walk away with any great doctrinal implications, at least not this portion of the chapter. If you're teaching it back here, it's going to last about 5 minutes, long enough to read it. There's really nothing to add. But God was with His people every step. He knew where they were every time they moved, and it's written down. And the Lord tells us, I'll never leave you and I'll never forsake you. So you know what? If you can't get anything else, you can get that. Because that's in here. All right, verse 50. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you pass over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their metal images and demolish all their high places. You shall take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot according to your clans. To a large tribe you shall give a large inheritance. To a small tribe you shall give a small inheritance. Wherever the lot falls for anyone, that shall be his according to the tribes of your fathers. You shall inherit. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then by those of them whom you let remain shall be barbs in your eyes and thorns in your side. And they shall trouble you in the land where you dwell, and I will do to you as I thought to do to them. God instructs Moses here to tell the people to completely wipe out the Canaanites. In fact, in other places, we are told specifically, kill them all and don't leave a survivor. No survivors. They're all to die. You know, if you read after people, there are people that are really confused about that. Why would God do that? These were just people living in their own land, minding their own business. Wrong. That is not the case. These were very sinful countries. These weren't people who were living in their own land, minding their own business, trying to be good people or anything like that. That's not the case at all. One of the promises that God gave to Abraham is that your people will go into a foreign country. And when the time of the Amorites, the iniquity of the Amorites was complete, then I'm going to bring them out and I'm going to go wipe those people up. See, the iniquity of the Amorites is complete when Israel comes out of Egypt. You say, wait, I thought that was all just about Israel. No, God's the God of the whole world. It coincided perfectly, but while God's time to visit them and bring them out of Egypt was right, so God's time to destroy the Canaanites was right too. And that's what it says, word for word, in Genesis 15:16, that the iniquity of the Amorites would be complete. God was actually long-suffering with these people. They were sinful peoples back in the days of Abraham. And for hundreds of years, God allowed them to live, sinful as they were, and He left them alone. And they were allowed to live in freedom. That's not called judgment. That's called long-suffering. Now, we're seeing judgment in the book of Joshua on these people. But the fact that God allowed them to live like that for so long, that's the long-suffering of God. God was actually good to these people. in allowing them to live when they were as sinful as they are. If you look up the sins of the Canaanites, just, you know, search it, you'll be surprised what all you come back with. Deuteronomy tells us a little bit. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 10. There shall not be found among you... By the way, this is the re-giving of the law. Don't forget, God is, through Moses, telling the Jews this before they enter the promised land. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering to the Lord. Anyone who practices divination or tells fortunes or interprets omens, or a sorcerer or a charmer or a medium or a necromancer or one who inquires of the dead. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. You want an abomination? False worship. Paganism. That's an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominations, the Lord is driving them out before you. These were wicked people. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God for these nations which you are about to dispossess. Listen to fortune tellers and diviners. But as for you, the Lord has not allowed you to do this. So God is driving out a wicked people. They're not, it's not like these people are just good old folks and God's driving them out. These are wicked people that God is driving out. He is just using Israel to do it. They were to destroy all the idols that the people possessed. And if they didn't follow the instructions, the Canaanites would be a thorn in their side. And in fact, he says a little bit more than that. Look at verse 55. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then those of them whom you let remain shall be as barbs in your eyes. You'd rather have a barb in your eye or a thorn inside? I'd rather have a thorn in my side. That's right. Of course, they'd have both. They shall be trouble in the land where you dwell, and I will do to you as I thought to do to them. What we see in the Middle East today? Fulfillment. They never fully drove them out. They allowed some to live. They're still suffering for it now. Would you say that Israel has barbs in their eyes and thorns in their side now? Have you, if not, you're not keeping up. The Middle East is in constant turmoil. There is a Middle East crisis all the time. I don't know why they call it a crisis. To me, a crisis is something that just sort of boils, and then comes to a crisis. It's always chaotic over there. Right, here's why. They never fully drove them out. And there's still barbs in their eyes and thorns in their side. Good Lord willing, we got one more week of Numbers. After that, I plan on moving to Hebrews. Haven't changed on that. Now, when you go read it next week and I change the next week, I'm sorry. That has happened. But I am planning on going through Hebrews. It seems like after we've dealt with this book about the early beginnings of the nation of Israel, after they came out of Egypt, it seems like that it would be a great thing to go read a book that is directed towards them. You know, in the New Testament, it just seems like a good time to do that. Hope that it's been a benefit to you. I'm asking you to stand, if you will. Brother Burrell, do you mind dismissing us, sir?